Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Wow. What an episode. What a conversation. Yes. I'm so excited for everyone to listen to it.
This is a fun Ethnically Ambiguous, and we have a great guest. We have a chef, a baker, an activist, just like also like a really cool person.
Genuinely very cool.
Yeah, Rima Seal is here with us. It's like the best. I mean, we talk about her upbringing, her background, being Palestinian by way of Lebanon. We'll explain. And also Syrian.
Being Syrian. Yeah, yeah. Don't forget the Syrian.
And then, you know, her work within activism and what led her to opening up her bakery slash restaurant in the Bay Area. There's two locations.
And Mission and Fruitvale.
Yes. So go find them.
Go find them. Reams, California. Enjoy the episode. You're going to fall in love with her just as much as we did.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pets? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Wow, what a day. It's springtime.
It's springtime.
I never know what to say on the intros, even though we've been doing this for like 4 years, 3 years.
It's springtime officially.
Yeah, you have a beautiful new haircut. The first time I've seen it is on the Zoom. I love it so much. We both had hair transformations recently, and I'm all about it.
Yes, we did. You know, we're soon coming out of hopefully this pandemic, and we're going to have a new look, kind of.
Yes.
We'll see.
It's like a butterfly coming out of a cocoon. Here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope so. Well, we have a very exciting guest today.
Yeah. Actually, a previous guest of the show, whose episode has already come out, Jibril Younes, he's the one that kind of connected us together with Reem. Our guest is Reem Aseel. She's incredible. She's a baker, a chef, a activist. I have so many questions for her. She's so cool. Let's just bring her right in. Hello. Yeah. Welcome, Reem.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for making time to be on our show.
Yeah.
I went through a hair transformation, too.
Oh, yeah,
can't really see it, but I kind of did the blonde thing. I tried to go gray, but my hair wants to go blonde.
Yeah, nice.
I'm into that. Yeah,
curls everywhere.
I went full blonde recently. Yeah. And Anna's also done the same. Like, I feel like me and Anna, like, sometimes I'm brown. Like, for a while, she was blonde and I was brown, and now it's switched. It's kind of funny to me.
But now I've given up on my hair, and I actually am just letting it all go gray.
Yeah,
at this point.
Yeah, it's the way to go.
Yeah,
I think it's a sign of like badassness, you know?
Yes.
Like grays are sick.
It's like Storm. Like it can be X-Men.
Exactly.
I hope so.
Well,
I hope I'm as cool as
Storm. We're already getting along so well. My internal monologue is just completely external at this point in the pandemic. But regardless, we're both so excited to talk to you. And I feel like a kind of a degree of separation from you because you catered the Sofra Daimit dinner event and I wasn't able to go because I was out of town, but I did contribute to the zine and I've heard only the best things about your cooking. I'm so bummed that I couldn't try it myself. It was supposed to be a whole thing. I wanted my parents to come and everything, but I couldn't make it work. But yeah, I'm so excited to finally talk to the one and only Reem Aseel. So let's just start from the beginning.
Yeah.
It's annoying that I have to ask, not annoying. I'm annoyed with myself that I know a little bit about you and I have to pretend I'm hearing it for the first time. But I also don't want to be like, you grew up here, your dad and mom are this. So I really would like to hear it from you. Tell the audience where you were born, about your parents and about your upbringing in general.
Yeah, so I was born in a little town 20 minutes outside of Boston, Massachusetts. My parents, my mom is Palestinian by way of Lebanon, and my dad is Syrian, and they immigrated here. My dad in the late 70s, my mom when she married my father in the early 80s, and settled in this very small, woodsy, suburban town. In Massachusetts.
Yeah. I imagine it was probably pretty white
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were but a handful of brown kids living in just a sea of whiteness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My mom always shares a story that my dad, when they first moved to Boston, the first thing he did was open up the, what is it, the yellow pages or the white pages? You know, do you remember when those existed?
Yeah.
And he looked up like every everybody with the name Muhammad and like called them up to make community. And so
that's
we
so kind of
slowly grew our community. But yeah, in our small town where I went to school, it was like, yeah, it's very, yeah. very white.
I'm curious. So your mom is originally Palestinian, but she was raised in Lebanon or moved there at a certain age?
Yeah, moved is like a nice way to say it.
She was displaced.
Yeah, she was displaced. My mom is from Gaza. She was born in Gaza up until she was 8 in 1967, which, as folks know, was sort of the sort of second takeover when Israel expanded its borders. And at that time, like the Gaza and Egypt had sort of the borders were a little bit more fluid. And so they knew something was coming down. And so they're like, okay, maybe we should lay low in Beirut and in case something happens, in case there's an invasion, and basically took a very long vacation and realized that they couldn't go back. So So they settled in Beirut.
Beirut is like the place you go to lay low compared to Palestine. It's like, that's where you go. It's like, well, what are you going to do?
Well, little did they know that laying low there meant like experiencing like a decade and a half of civil war.
Yeah.
Go figure. But yeah.
Yeah. So your parents met in Beirut and your dad is from Damascus?
Yeah. So my dad is from Damascus. There's this thing about Syrians, in order to sort of evade having to be in the army, you just like just stay in education for as long as possible.
Yep. A lot of my cousins did that. Yeah. A lot of my family members did
that. Are you Syrian?
Yeah, I'm Syrian. Yeah. My dad's also from Damascus. And I wanted to ask eventually, but I'm bringing it up right now anyway. I feel like men and women, I guess, but especially men from Damascus, they have this very particular pride. Does your dad have this particular pride about being so Shami?
Yeah, he almost like gets upset that my Palestinian identity becomes front and center a lot because it is. It just, I think the nature of being Palestinian, it just trumps everything else sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, he's like, why can't you like express your pride in being Shami? Yo, Shami and a Sham. You know, no, he has that nostalgia and that. Yeah, but he like, he studied in Egypt for a while. He was part of like the, I don't know, there was like a moment in history when Egypt and Lebanon and Syria were one country and then decided that was a really bad idea.
Yeah.
Then split. But yeah, he was like traveling and then he sort of settled. He went to grad school in the US and then decided to go back home, and it was like either he pursued more higher education or he got married, and he decided to get married. And we have family members who moved to Lebanon. And so, it's a funny story. Like my grandfather had a textile, like a little fabric shop, and his brother-in-law was one of his regulars. So they went into the shop and like, he saw my mom and it was like love at first sight.
It's always like that, right? My dad's all very like
dramatic.
She walked into the office and I was like, I'm going to marry her. And I'm like, sure. Okay.
My mom was like, get me the hell out of Lebanon.
It's always the same story. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's how they met. And then, yeah, they got married in Lebanon, but then, the first place they lived in the U.S. was actually very funny because it was Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which for folks who don't know Lancaster, it's like Amish country. It was like where my dad got his first engineering job. And
interesting.
My mom was very shell-shocked coming from like the metropolis of Swana into this very like horse and buggy town.
Wow.
That's interesting. I can't even imagine.
I can't wrap my head around that.
It's like whitest America you could go to.
My parents would be so confused. They'd be like, this is America? Like, where are they?
This is what everybody is talking about. The promised land.
Right.
Like,
Wait, is your dad a civil engineer?
He's a mechanical engineer. Electrical engineer. Oh, my God.
Both our dads are engineers as well.
Yes.
Well, both of my parents.
Yeah.
My mom's an engineer, a
doctor.
Yeah. My mom's also an electrical engineer. My dad's a civil engineer because there's only three professions.
Yeah. I know. There's really only three.
The doctor, lawyer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I did not get those genes. My sister is an electrical engineer, but that's as far as we went on that side.
My sister's a doctor, and that's as far as we went. And there's, I feel like every kid that doesn't become a doctor, if they have a sister who's already a doctor or a brother or whatever, me and Anna have the same experience where our parents were like, you're going to be a lawyer, be a judge, you're good at arguing.
Yeah.
Just like, just because I don't listen to you doesn't mean I want to be a judge. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, that's what my parents said. You're studying the humanities. You should be a lawyer.
Exactly.
Like, they were really devastated when I was like, I'm studying international relations. They're like, what is that?
No such thing to them. Yeah, to them, no that means thing. It's like, so you won't be able to afford anything.
Mm-hmm.
No health insurance. Good luck out there.
Yep. Well, you can imagine what they felt when I went from my nonprofit job to being a baker.
Well, let's get into that.
Oh my God. Should we be worried about you?
So what were you doing right before you decided to make that leap?
Yeah. So I had, I had discovered the very fun profession of organizing professionally. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And that different realms. I was a community organizer for a little bit of time, really working in communities, primarily here in the Bay Area where I've lived for the last almost 20 years now. It's so crazy to say that. But all over the country, sort of teaching folks how to really start their own campaigns to win tangible things in their lives and, just have a voice in the decisions that were impacting their lives, particularly around like some very basic rights, right? Like affordable housing and living wages. And then I sort of dabbled in labor organizing where I was really organizing people in the workplace. I organized service airport workers in the airports. Like I literally went into the airports and like pretended to be a student getting information from and helped them organize a union. And all that work was really amazing. I sort of got burnt out. It was like, working the nonprofit jobs for very little pay and a lot of hours, which ironically I do now. Here we are. But yeah, it was hard because in the world of nonprofits, like you're doing this like amazing work that you want to be transformative with communities. And then the funders decide this is not the cool thing to invest our money anymore.
Right.
And then you have to like switch campaigns or, and I got tired of just like turning people out to rallies and we're getting so close to this like systemic change. And then we have to switch priorities and. So I didn't feel like I was accomplishing what I fell in love with organizing for the first, like what really attracted me to organizing in the first place. And so, I really sort of got burnt out and wanted to take some time away. And my father back in 2010 was like, I'm going to Syria. Do you want to come with me? And at that time, my relationship with my father was definitely a bit more estranged. So I was like, okay, this could be a really good opportunity to reconnect with my father and, even my Syrian roots, all of that, there was like a certain time of my life that I was going through. And so I took a chance and went on this amazing life-changing journey, which basically turned me into a baker.
Wow.
We spent a summer in Syria. And one of the things I said was like, and I'm sure maybe you can relate to this. It's like, if you ever go back home to visit family, it's not really a vacation. And particularly my dad's side of the family, they're pretty conservative. So
yeah,
it was really
too.
Hard. It's like hard to grapple with that. I'm like the only non-covered woman, all of these things. And I was like, we can't sit with like your, my dad has like 8 sisters who have kids. Like we literally have to write everybody's name to like get it right in terms of who's where and how many presents.
Sounds right.
Yeah. So, yep. So I was like, we have to see other parts of Syria. That was the one request that I made. And we were really lucky because I feel like half the places we visited, we can't visit anymore.
Yeah.
Given what's happened in Syria. But we went up the coast of Syria. We went to Ladiyeh and Kesab. We didn't make it all the way. Yeah. All of these villages. Yeah. And I just got to see how multi-ethnic and multicultural and even just the span of religions and all the things that comprise. Syria was a refuge for so many communities. Mm-hmm. And people don't know that. I didn't know that. It's very homogenous the way I even looked at my family and the way of life. And there's just so much more. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big epiphany.
Yeah.
And
were you interested in baking before you went to Syria, or was it something that amplified?
Yeah. I feel like I dabbled with food a lot. Food has always sort of been in the backdrop of whenever I was having a hard time. It's kind of sitting there. It's my refuge. And it's really the act of feeding people. I think that I have a very complicated relationship to food, both eating it and making it. I saw my mom really struggle with being a 21st century woman, with these feminist values. And she struggled with having to balance being in the kitchen, but also having a career. And I never wanted that. I never wanted to so I was always sort of shied away from the kitchen, but I always felt myself going back and making. I think it was a yearning to cultivate something tangible, because organizing, you don't get those tangible results all the time. It's such a process.
Right.
But the act of feeding people, you see, you're literally nourishing people. And so I was already thinking about it. I was an amateur baker.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until Syria where I really discovered bread. I was doing sweets, and I really liked the alchemy of baking a cake, putting all these ingredients. And it was very mathematical and it all made sense. But it wasn't until I sort of went to the Arab world where I discovered bread as sort of a central component of that.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw a woman baking the bread on the Saj. It was
It's all puffy, the puffy one?
Yeah, where you slap it. I mean, that's how we make our mana'ish now.
Yeah.
And it bubbles up, and there was wood fire under, and she was showing me how to make it. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I saw her starter that she was using to make the dough. And it was all very just fascinating to me. And then I saw the bakery, especially when we went to Lebanon, as this place where there's so much life. And I was like, I want that. How do I have that? Yeah. How do I bring that to the U.S. And particularly to my community?
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't just the Arab community, but a lot of different communities I had been felt connected to. I just came back and immediately enrolled myself into culinary school and was I need to learn how to be a baker technically before I can even think about Reims. But I knew exactly when I sort of saw that in the Arab world that that's what I wanted. That was very clear to me even before I became a baker.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was a means to that end.
It's an amazing thing. When you go, I remember when I went to Iran, I was I was obsessed with watching the bread be made. I would take long videos of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they would all just be sitting and staring at me. And I'd be like, no, keep going. I love this.
Yeah.
I would wake up. We had a family friend who would come and get me because, as a woman in Iran, everyone, it's always just family takes you everywhere. And it's also very restrictive, just like in any other kind of Middle East countries. But they would come and take me at 5 in the morning so I could just sit with them and watch them make the bread. It was my big outing for the day. I was I'm going to go watch the bread be made. And I remember one time we walked by a bakery and they were making bread at night, and they're using the sangak, which is
do
it on the rocks,
on the rocks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sabun. That's the Palestinian way. Yeah
So it's amazing to watch all these different ways that they make bread, or bad about it, all this stuff. And it's there's something so like pleasant. It's just it's like one of my favorite things to watch bread be made.
Yes.
And
me
these
too.
Guys are like in their like, you know, they're in their zone and they're just grabbing their bread. Yeah. They make it. They put it
it's
up.
Like big,
you know?
It's always big burly men.
We're making that's really so fascinating because like my mom and I are obsessed with bread and like I've said this to her multiple times, but I wish I smelled like a bakery. Like that's like all I want. And I'm fascinated. Smell. Yeah, it's just like an amazing smell. And Syrian bread, I miss it so much. It is so good. Like samune or like anything else, like menaish. And yeah, like Anna said, like it's one of my favorite things to see. Like bread being made, food being made. I always watch my mom, if not help her with food being made, but like it's bread unites us all.
I'm curious.
It's very transcendent.
In the bakeries, did you guys, I don't know if this is just an Iranian thing, but they all the men working were always all wearing sandals. That's what you noticed.
Yeah.
It was just something I always noticed. Like, they all wear sandals. They're all very comfortable and they're making up their bread. Like,
that's hilarious.
That pans out. I mean, like they're in a desert.
It's hot. Yeah. I don't know. I had never paid attention to their shoes, but I would not be surprised. I do have this like memory of going to Glendale.
Yeah.
To the like Armenian bakeries and seeing the woman in flip-flops.
Yeah.
Making that dough.
I always assumed in Syria they wore sandals. Like my grandfather always wore sandals and every person that went to the mosque would wear sandals if they were a man because it's like easier
to
do wudu.
Yeah, totally.
Also, you have to wear them in the house because they always say your feet will get cold from the ground. Which you're like, okay. Oh. That's why now I do it naturally. I literally have home sandals that I wear.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Because I'm, a product of my culture.
If my mom sees me barefoot in the house without house slippers, she like won't talk to me until I have them on.
Yeah.
Like,
oh my God.
If I don't have my shahata on, it's over.
Yeah, my mom always goes like, come on, here, I have some for you. You can wear extra. Yes, I have extra ones. Here, come put them on. Your feet are going to get cold.
So exactly.
Okay.
But I do think it's really beautiful, honestly, that you transitioned from organizing, active, like a community building to something that I think is actually kind of the same thing.
You know, it's right. Mm-hmm.
I did watch the episode that you were on Ugly Delicious, and they talked about how food and food culture, it travels to different places and it becomes a home for people that are displaced. Like there's a place in San Diego now, it opened up a couple years ago. It's called Mal Sham. And it's like, I've never had American food that tasted so similar to Syrian food. And my dad and mom feel the same way. It's like, it brings him back to Syria. And it's a beautiful thing to witness. And I can only imagine Palestinians feeling the same way with Reims. And it's like, really beautiful thing to cultivate because you're providing a home for people that maybe don't feel like they have one anymore. And
yeah. I would say also, though, like my food is not easy to pinpoint. You know, obviously it's from Bilad al-Sham, which is, you know, it's hard. You know, food travels and it's influenced by the many sort of conditions. And even my grandmother, you know, when they relocated to Lebanon, it's like she took on. You know, it was like she had sort of her traditional Palestinian way and then took on sort of the Lebanese methods. And then when my parents immigrated to the U.S., like, this is very common of U.S. mothers, the practicality of having to like keep up and the lack of ingredients and sort of avail, especially like living in the East Coast, we had like no produce.
Right.
I didn't know what a real tomato was until I moved to California.
Wow.
But, you know, you had to adapt. And so a lot of my recipes are sort of tell the story of adaptation and resilience. Mm-hmm. And I think that as a result of that, you know, my food is very much, it's as much California as it is Palestinian, or
of
it's
course,
as much Lebanese as it is Syria. It's like you can't pinpoint one thing, which makes it kind of magical because I feel, and I've been told by people who are not even Arab, that there's something familiar about it.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful.
You know? And so I think that food has that power to do that.
Yeah.
In some way. But really what I wanted to try to do is kind of create that warmth of Arab hospitality because that is what I felt when I went there. So it's more about the feeling and the nostalgia and the sort of
how Arab hospitality
makes you feel at home. It doesn't matter where you're from.
Like Middle Eastern hospitality, it's all about inviting you in, feeding you. It's just like an essential, like the kitchen is an essential part of, and a very important part of our heritage. It's just, right. It defines the culture and how generous it is, how hospitality is so important in general.
It's a virtue. But,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's like really actually is. Like, you have to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it really,
it kind of, it's also like, so, I mean, and growing up, like, our family and like in Iran is like you would make so much food for everyone because you'd have these big families and then there was just no table big enough, so you would lay it all out on the ground on like a sofra or a you know like any sort whatever yeah. they modern day sofras, they just have these long plastic like tablecloths they pull out literally from like a roll ready to go yeah. to eat on the floor, and then everyone just sits on the floor except for the very much older family members who struggle to sit on the floor, then they get a chair.
My grandma, for example.
But then, like, you just all sit on the ground together and eat. And it's like, it's the most communal feeling. And I always miss that the most from Iran because my family's not big enough to really make a reason to.
Yeah.
I miss that too. And it, like, even my mom, like, when my grandparents lived with us and my uncle was nearby, there was a time when we had more family around for like a year or something because most of the time we were all by ourselves. But she's used to making these big quantities because she's used to having like these feasts with her family, you know? And my mom and her mom, amazing cooks. I've never, like, my mom's cooking is my favorite thing in the world, but it's the same thing that you said about your mom. She had to adapt. She didn't know what za'atar meant in English. She didn't know what, like, she still doesn't know what mukhiya is in English. Like, I don't even know either. Like, and so you just have to adapt her. Like, she would get sent, like, back when it was possible, like, she would get sent spices from Syria. And every time she would go to Syria, we would get a bunch of things in our suitcase. But yeah.
But it is kind of like, I think I felt very inspired. I mean, I have a lot of privilege, but I feel very inspired by people who've brought a piece of home, especially people who've been displaced. I've been able to create a sense of home, like away from home. And, you know, if that means preserving seed or bringing back spices and all those things, like all of those are really important.
But I think the fact that you're place, your Reims, is not just, as you said, it's not just Palestinian. It's like, it's representing like people that have had to adapt. And also just like, it's it's a testament to the resilience, and that one silver lining of so much tragedy and suffering is that you're able to introduce people to delicious food.
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
We have so much more to talk about, but before we get any further, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. And we're back. I glossed over this, but if any of you haven't listened, audience members, or not listened, watched the Ugly Delicious episode that Reem is on, go to Netflix. It's season 2, episode 4. It's very interesting. Turns. Yes, it's all about the vertical meat or vertical spit, they call it, about how like how shawarma is made and also how gyros are made and how el pastor is made. You understand the origins of all of that, and it's fascinating.
Arab origins.
Also, as a bonus, if you want to see a cameo of my child and me, we also have a little piece in the parent one.
Oh, I missed that. I have to go back and watch it. But there is something in that episode that we've both talked about all the time, and I think about it all the time too. But it's part of how white people colonize everything, but even the term Middle East and Far East, it's all relative to Europe. It's all relative to whiteness. And because like Middle East does include Iran, but like Mediterranean might not, you know? And I feel like instead of calling something
who doesn't.
And it's like we almost make it more palatable for white people to be like Mediterranean food or whatever the shit, because they're more comfortable with Greek because it's mostly like more like them or something. I don't know.
Iran is a bad word. Arab is a bad word. All these phrases, and you know, for a long time, the generations before us had to protect themselves, right? And they've added to this phenomenon because of survival. We live in a very xenophobic political climate, and this happened long before Trump was in power. And I think that this generation, it's like we're trying to like reclaim and be like, like we're going to call these things what they are.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad word. And it's something to be celebrated, you know?
I wanted to bring it up because I wanted to know if you have a better term for Middle East. Like, is there a better, what should we use? I don't know.
Yeah. So I use the term Swana. Southwest Asia and North Africa. And it is basically geographical. It's objective.
And it's more unifying in a way.
And it's more unifying. Yeah. I mean, I think that that region is so complex, right? It's not just Arab. Ethnically, it's Armenian, Muslim, it's Kurdish. It's, you know, it's all the different ethnic groups that live and dwell in those countries. And there's a political identity there. And so, yeah, I feel like that is a very unifying terminology. Sometimes I'll like say Levantine or Levant when I want to describe sort of Bilad al-Sham, because people are like, what's Bilad al-Sham?
My mom says the same thing.
Greater Syria. But like even Levantine is a colonizer term. That's the term French, you know. So there's definitely contradictions and language limitations that I'm grappling with and trying to figure out. But when I can, I usually use the term Swana.
Yeah, I do like Bilad al-Sham. My mom always says, my mom and dad both say that. And it's like, because Lebanon, Syria, so many other countries, they used to just be one thing. And
Palestine,
And Palestine too. These arbitrary borders by white people have just like, it's just, I just hate it. I hate colonizing the idea that white people literally just like draw lines on a map. Yeah. I hate it so much.
Yes.
Speaking of racism, and especially in our country, like, so you grew up in a pretty white area. What led you out to California eventually?
So I went to school in the East Coast. I continued my higher education. I went to a very small liberal arts college called Tufts in the in Boston. Are you guys familiar?
I'm a little familiar. I have a lot of friends that are from Massachusetts for some reason. Two of them went to Tufts.
And you know, at that time, you know, it's like you're the like immigrant prototype Arab child, higher education. That was like the next thing that you do. I knew I wanted to be a change maker. Like I already had sort of a affinity for social justice work, but I think, you know, like a lot of folks, your sort of identity really gets shaped by that sort of next phase of being away from your family. And certainly for me, my second week entering college was 9/11. Whoa. So you can imagine the like fate and everything sort of. And so, and I was in the East Coast, and the East Coast was generally a very conservative place. And I was in a like Tufts, just to kind of give like the makeup, demographic makeup. It was a very, it was filled with a lot of Zionism, right? So like,
interesting.
People from the tri-state area. And so being a Palestinian was like, just made you a target, you know, and being open about being Palestinian. It was the first time I learned how to be open about being Palestinian. Up until then, I really felt like I hid my identity. People are like, where are you from? Like, Lebanon. You know, I'll just say something that people know in the news that's more, less threatening. But it was like college was really the time that, like, I met the Arab Students Union, and I was like, you know, I was like just becoming sort of aware of my identity. And yeah, I had not really understood what racism was intellectually until sort of my college years. And it all sort of came crashing. It's like I got that crash course within 6 months of 9/11 and saw a lot of horrible things happen to my community. You know, my, like the mosque that I grew up in being targeted, like a lifelong friend, you know, being entrapped by the FBI. You know, all these horrible things happened. Like, you know, the president of the Arab Students Union being almost beat up to death just for being, you know, he was Trinidadian Arab, and they were like calling him, it was like a frat that, you know, and they were like That's beating disgusting. Him up and calling him a Saddam supporter. And,
well,
you know, and this was happening in a liberal arts college. Yeah, and so yeah. I was like, get me the fuck away from mm-hmm. the East Coast and from this, because this is not what I want to do. And so I literally just chose California because it was the furthest away from all of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that experience, my world being turned upside down, my awareness of race and racism and all the cumulative effects
right.
of sort of having to suppress my identity and then sort of come out with my identity and then be criminalized mm-hmm. again. It's just like, I became really depressed, and I actually like it manifested in a really horrible, sickness. Like I had, what do you call that? The over-encompassing like acid reflux, gastro problems mm-hmm. where I couldn't eat. Like I literally just couldn't eat. I had dropped 30 pounds and
Whoa.
I just needed to leave. So I dropped out and I moved here, and it was around the time that the war was breaking out. The Bush administration had just invaded Iraq. And I think my anti-war activism here in the Bay Area just really sort of like set the course for the next 20 years. Like mm-hmm. I just, like a lot of people, like just fell in love with the Bay Area, and it was a lot mm-hmm. more diverse, and I was meeting a lot more people in struggle and, you know, finding the rhythm of power. Like I felt so powerless
right.
In college and in the East Coast. And I think the real education really started for me on the streets and mm-hmm. in meeting different communities.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I forgot your original question, but I think brought you to California.
Yeah, I was curious why you came to California, but that really encompasses it.
My grandparents had immigrated, like a lot of my mom's side of the family, when they moved to the U.S., actually immigrated to L.A.
Oh,
so okay. a lot of them are based in San Fernando Valley. And mm-hmm. I wanted to go to L.A., but then I was like, I'd be bored in L.A. So it was just by chance that I moved to the Bay mm-hmm. Area. I had an uncle living up here, but I always felt like I was a West Coaster trapped in an East Coaster's body.
Right.
Like I just was more, I'm like the hippie child of my family.
Mm-hmm.
I was always sort of just like questioning the world and wanting to be creative. And
are you the sensitive one?
Yeah, sensitive one.
Ada and I are both the sensitive ones.
Yeah, yeah. And so like it made sense. Like my parents knew when I was like, I just want to like, because it's just like not a good place for someone with high anxiety to be on the mm-hmm. East Coast. It's just so competitive. And
yeah,
those cold winter months, it's just not the business.
Also mm-hmm. on top of like extreme Islamophobia.
Totally. It's not, yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine
I learned
that.
In California, it's not much different. It's a little bit more subtle.
Yeah. 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 They found a way to still other you in a way, but like being like West Coast chill about it. And you're like,
yeah, exactly.
Still not okay.
Like, you can't ask me where I'm from like 100 gajillion times. If I tell you Boston, that's going to be my answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. My parents did, they immigrate. I was born in Anaheim, and there's a very uh-huh. big air population in Anaheim. They're trying to officialize the community of Little Arabia right now because mm-hmm. it's so big.
So big,
I mean, to be fair, it's also very conservative. So I think you may have made the right choice. But
skin folk are not necessarily kinfolk, as they say.
Yeah. But until like a couple years ago, when those hate crimes were happening in Berkeley, I didn't realize how much Zionism was in the Bay Area. I was very surprised. I thought it was mostly this like, I don't even know what I thought. I just didn't know how intense that Zionism was in California at all.
I didn't know until my bakery was attacked. I was like, wait, where all these people come from?
Yeah. You're very explicit in saying this is a Palestinian restaurant. And mm-hmm. it's almost like you have to be that territorial, not just about that name, but also about the food we have. Falafel, tabbouleh, it's all our food that becomes appropriated. And mm-hmm. it's a testament to your resilience that you didn't back down in spite of death threats and mm-hmm. all this stuff. But how did you come out of that? And how do you continue being a proud Palestinian restaurant?
I mean, one, to just say that, like, and I've been a Palestinian activist for a long time. I've worked on everything from boycott, divestment, sanctions mm-hmm. campaigns, little ones to big ones. So I've been a part of that work for a good chunk of time. And I would say all of that work really led up to the moment that I opened my bakery and mm-hmm. that people are just not, and maybe it's social media and like awareness, but the sort of act of denormalizing apartheid, mm-hmm. you know, and occupation of Palestinian land, that I think people, we have denormalized it a little bit. Now it's still frustrating when you have progressives, we're progressive on everything but Palestine. But for the most part, people know that Israel as an entity, as a government, is apartheid. Committing these heinous crimes against humanity, against mm-hmm. Palestinians. And so I think I had that on my side a little bit. Mm-hmm. I had this huge community that were like, what? You know, we're going to protect you. So, you know, I think had I not had that, I would have been really, really scared. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always like to give credit to that work. But because I'm not the only business owner that has been attacked, so I'm not going to be the last one. Mm-hmm. I realized that I had this platform and I could have shied away and be like, what are you talking about? Like, I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, like I could have kind of played that card of mm-hmm. like,
it's my both food of our
brings
food.
People together. Yeah. Well, I would never play that card.
Oh, like, that's
but
too far.
You know, like something along the lines of like pivot away from that and be like, I'm just about the food, but I'm so clearly not just about the food. I did not create Reams just to serve food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I did create it to challenge status quo. Like otherwise I wouldn't have opening a restaurant is thankless work. So mm-hmm. you better have some other purpose you're doing it for. And so I chose to double down on Rasmiya, who is the Palestinian activist, who's like an amazing woman. And my community and myself. And I remember Palestinian elders being like, it's amazing what you're doing. I would have never done that shit, but good for you. You know, I'm speaking for people who have less privilege to be able to speak up. And I have this platform now. And now thousands of people across the U.S. maybe know who Rasmiya was and what happened to her. You know, and that wasn't something I ever thought about. And so they call it sort of, I don't know. They almost helped me more than they hurt me. In fact, maybe I should do something controversial again because times are rough in COVID.
So but, just for context, the activist you're talking about, there's a mural in your restaurant of her, right? Yeah, okay.
Yes. Yeah, so I put up a mural of a Palestinian activist. And really the idea was that I wanted an Arab woman, a brown woman, her face looking down at me, telling me everything was going to be okay. Don't be scared. And at the time that I was opening my bakery, the government was basically trying to deport Rasmiya based on a bogus sort of saying that she lied on her immigration papers. She's been a citizen of this country for 20 years. Jeez. And for us, we knew this was like a clear sort of scapegoating of activists, sort of making an example of activists. Yeah. And so that was really my intention. And then as a result of it, got huge backlash from, you know, all over the world, really. I'm like, my small bakery could do this. Imagine what the power of that is. And so, so I think I have this platform and I chose at that point to lean into it and I continue to choose. And it's not always easy. I'm in these sort of more mainstream food spaces. I mean, like Food and Wine. Mm-hmm. Knowingly knew about this backlash and then voted us top 10 restaurant of 2018.
That's incredible.
Received backlash from the Zionists, put out an op-ed saying you all are fools and we know what this is about.
Yeah.
Like that's to me is a huge victory Arabs are.
Yeah.
When Food and Wine, whose headquarters are in Alabama, one of the most conservative parts of this country, are backing you up, it means that things have changed.
Yeah.
And we need to lean into that. I'm like, I mean, not to say people of color will never have their moment, but like, this is our moment
as Arabs,
as Black, Indigenous, folks of color, like all of that. We need to lean in on this moment.
Yeah,
I agree. And you were a finalist of the James Beard Award,
a semi-finalist.
Wow. That's still amazing.
That's so cool. Yeah.
I think like what you said about like, older Palestinians or Arabs or Middle Easterners just, or Swanas, people from the Swana region, saying that I would never do this, but good for you. It's a testament to what you're saying is like society is slowly changing. And I was so amazed when celebrities started speaking out about it, like Jewish celebrities that everyone's like, that was the biggest thing for me. I was like, oh, things are actually shifting. People are talking about it in a very objective, logical way for the first time ever. So,
I say this about the mural. I remember, like, you know, the reporters, they wanted a good story and they wanted to make me controversial. And I was like, I wonder to myself, who was the first person who put Malcolm X up on their wall or who put Nelson Mandela up on their wall? At one point, they were terrorists, you know, like, and so if I'm part of history of denormalizing sort of the criminalization of our people, then so be it. Like, I'm that one, you know.
Yeah.
And then Nelson Mandela is now, you know, will go down in history as, you know, he got a Nobel Peace Prize, you know. So it's like the world changes, but it takes time. Courage.
Courage.
It takes courage
time.
Of people to step up and pave that path. So, yeah, I feel very fortunate to be in the position that I'm in, and it's not always easy. I wouldn't romanticize it by any means, all of the silliness I have to face in the food world in particular.
I mean, silliness is very kind, but the racism, so everything.
The silliness. Yeah. I'll just say
but,
that.
I think by default, a lot of the times marginalized communities, folks of color, they have to become an activist. Like, even your existence is an act of resistance. And so it's almost like we have no choice to defend ourselves or resist, because no one else, like, that's all we've got. We have to represent ourselves.
Honestly, it's exhausting too. It's like, how can we do that on our own terms and not be forced to have to do that all the time? Because, like, sometimes we just want to do
exist.
Our thing.
Yeah.
We just want to exist.
We just want to exist without being a political statement.
Yeah.
You know,
it's unfortunate that it has to be that way. But, like, if you don't continue to push, you know, white people will very easily be comfortable just kind of like dismissing you. Like, well, you know, like, I mean, she's not like their favorite. I feel like a lot of things, like, if you don't say anything, they're like, well, you never complained, so I thought it wasn't an issue. And you're like,
yeah, we're cool like that.
Yeah. Like, I shouldn't have to complain.
Yeah,
like, we're trying to make a point.
Or like the tokenizing, right? When people feel like they're celebrating you, but they're taking away agency from you. And I think that, especially women, I feel like that has been one of the biggest things that I've had to grapple with. It's like, oh, semi-finalist. Okay, you like threw in your little, some brown bodies in there.
Some diversity,
now you're good.
Quota.
Racism is over.
You know, like, I mean, I think, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area, and I felt a lot of that. My parents, because they've been in the Bay Area for so long, but had immigrated from Iran, like, they are like their own, like, quintessentially, like, hippies from, like, Berkeley and area. Like, they are who they are, you know? And you feel it, like, there, it is like a racist, like, microaggression that they do, where it's like, you're so interesting because you're so cultural, and it's almost, you almost feel like you're being collected, like the
it's
white
so
people are like collecting
annoying.
You to feel more cultured. And like, I have friends who to this day speak to me a certain way, and like, I know what's going on. And at times, like, I may not directly say it to their faces, like, hey, you know what, we're not like friends because I'm interesting. We're friends because we get along well, you know? And you want to like be like, what the heck? But that is specifically in my mind growing up, like, a Bay Area vibe. It's like progressive, but at the same time, an underlying of like racism because you're being fetishized in a way.
Yeah.
And that's like
I was like, what is going on? Am I in the, like, Twilight Zone? But I love that. It's like you're being collected. It's like, oh, I want to have you as my friend so I can say that I have this kind of friend.
It's very real. And I've truly, like, I've ignored it for a very long time in my life. And then at one point, you know, as I grew older and, you know, I would have, you know, just doing this podcast or just talking to more of my friends, like Shireen, who has more, you know, like, a true outlook on life, like, other people who grew up in other parts, like, you start to be like, That was weird. That was pretty weird. And I really just kind of ignored it because I've been taught to kind of ignore those microaggressions and not be like loud. And also it's culturally, like as a woman in, you know, the Swana sort of culture, you're supposed to be like quiet and, you know, in your lane, basically. You're not supposed to be like a loud Muslim woman or a loud Persian woman or a loud Arab woman. Yeah. Like, you're not supposed to be any of that. You're supposed to be like a good, you know, you stay in your lane, you cook, you take care of your family, like just traditional. But and then after a while, I was like, wait, no, I'm actually, you know, we're learning to speak up now more than ever as we grow as society and as we become more progressive adults. It's like you're starting to be like, I can actually say something and I don't have to worry about how it reflects back on me. I can just like speak up and be like, that makes me uncomfortable.
And I think that act of all of us kind of speaking up is important so other people know Arab women, Middle Eastern women, Muslim women, Persian women, there's not just one shade of that, you know? They, I feel like they just assume like, oh, you're Muslim? Like, does your dad allow you to go out of the house kind of thing? Like, they have this assumption that like the stereotypical go-to things that the media has spewed is the only thing they think about. So I think our existence,
I try not to like... Yeah, the homogenization of our cultures and the confusion. Did you see me call out David Chang when he was confusing Iran with something else? Yeah. I can't remember what I can't remember what the clip was, but I feel like they got me being like, that's Iran. That's I don't remember what he said.
What I really liked that you called him out on, that I really loved, that he kind of skirted, is that he was like, when the Muslim, I was so upset about the Muslim ban happening.
I'm like,
I was,
did you do anything about it?
Yeah. It was like, I was gutted. I couldn't believe it. And you immediately were like, well, what did you do about it? Did you post? And he was like, I just didn't have enough information to know what to say.
Love
and that's
that.
The go-to response that so many people have. It's like, I didn't have enough information, so I just kept quiet. When a Muslim ban, there's only one way to feel about it. There's really only one way to feel about it.
I was in Iran literally losing my hair thinking I wouldn't be able to come back into the country. Like, I was in, like, such a state. And that flight back to America after the Muslim ban happened, sat in a middle seat. It was 13 hours direct from Istanbul to the U.S. or to L.A. I did not close my eyes once. I sat there tense the whole time. Okay.
Oh,
it's like,
God.
You guys don't even know what Muslims or people of color from the Middle East or Swana origins have gone through during times like that when you're specifically targeted and said, you are a danger to this country. And it's like, I'm just a dumb Iranian American girl who went to go visit her family at a very inconvenient time. Okay.
Oh, man.
I am no threat.
I can only imagine. Yeah. Oh, wow.
And it's mind numbing.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. I love that you called him out on that because.
But I try to push people. That's why I like Reams is like really hip. And I mean, most of our staff is not even Arab, you know, but it has a very strong Arab identity still. Yeah. It's like, and it really sort of pushes the envelope on sort of how do you create space that is vibrant and multicultural and appreciates, not appropriates a cuisine and a culture, right? And I do that really so that I'm not that cliche or that like, what is it called? Like the Orientalism of region of like, we're all the same. We're all like, you know, the Aladdin scripture. Like a lot of, I feel like a lot of these like restaurants, they
Arabian Nights, they kind of
Arabian Nights, they lean into that. And I'm like, nope, I don't want anything cliche, you know, like everything is very like intentional.
But it's interesting because it's like that. A lot of the food blends because as regions, as people moved around through regions, we have a lot of similarities and yet we are different.
Totally.
It's very, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah, colonization definitely has its stories of like where it's like made things more distinct because of the separation. But also there's like, you know, I mean, I always use the example of Mexico and the Lebanese coming there and
revolutionizing
all of
like
the Arabs. Yeah,
like
people
like,
borrowing from each other. And like that's a story of colonization, which is not a pretty story, but like, or the Spaniards bringing, you know, their foods to Mexico when they colonized it. Like, that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about it, you know. There's a reason why, you know, the food in Spain looks like the food in Middle East. Like, that's like the North African influence or whatever, you know. So I really feel like just telling the story and giving context, like food divorced from its context is not all that interesting, actually. Like, I want to know why you guys bake your bread on rocks the way Palestinians do. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like, that's interesting to me. It's like cultures have figured out a way to adapt and people have traveled through the region and like learned from each other. And mm-hmm. that's something to be celebrated. So
yeah, 100%. Yeah. There's no
jockeying for like exclusive ownership. But telling the stories behind it.
Yeah. Food divorced from its, what'd you say? Culture or history. Is it interesting? You know?
Yeah.
That's a great little sound.
But bite. I kind of call it when I see people like laying exclusive claim to something to as a form of conquest, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to name that. I'm always going to call that when I see it. So.
Yeah. That's true.
I came up with this with myself. I'm like, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
You went to some country.
Yeah.
You know,
that's my gripe with, in particular, like Israeli cuisine that is very obviously that adapted from people that they've occupied and
then they go out of their way not to say Palestinian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They even say all the other Arab countries,
mm-hmm.
you know, Syria,
it's really shameful.
Yemen. I'm like, wait, I'm pretty sure that, the Moroccans didn't eat hummus. This is not Moroccan.
Yeah,
like, it's really out of your way to say Palestinian.
It's very shameful. This is a very late second break, but we haven't taken a second break yet. Let's take a break and we'll be right back with Reem. And we're back. This is such a fascinating conversation. I think we could talk to you for literally hours. But yeah, before the break, we were talking about sometimes when you are territorial about cuisine, it's like Israeli food being very obviously influenced by Arab food. And then them being so adamant about, the thing that gets me is that they're so adamant about, no, falafel is, this is Israeli, it's always Israeli tabbouleh, Israeli falafel. Like, it's just not really grinds my gears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very intentional way. It's mm-hmm. like when you, because having to say that they're Palestinian foods means having to admit that there are Palestinians there and that there's an occupation and a genocide and all these things. And the whole sort of premise of the state of Israel to exist as sort of an exclusively Jewish state is predicated upon the non-existence of this people mm-hmm. that were there, you know? And so it's very, very intentional. And a lot of money has gone into, especially in the U.S. I mean, you don't actually even see it as much there, ironically, from what I hear about people who mm-hmm. live in the region. But here in the U.S., because the U.S. is such an influencer, there is a huge intentional campaign of mm-hmm. Israeli chefs, right?
Yes.
Bringing Israeli food to the U.S. public, right? Mm-hmm. So.
That's what gets me is like, I saw this one white woman on like YouTube or something that was like cooking from an Israeli cookbook. And she was so impressed and fascinated, but it was like food that my mom has made. And I was just like, this, it just kind of made me sad, you know?
Yeah.
But speaking of moms, mm-hmm. I'm curious if your parents have visited Oakland and what they think of the food at Reem's.
So my mom lives down in LA and my dad lives in the East Coast, but they came for my grand opening.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, when I was like, I'm going to be a baker, they were like, what is going on with this child? Like they didn't understand my nonprofit job. They had like, didn't know how to describe to their family members that what organizing was. And now I'm becoming a baker. Like they were really worried. But I think when they saw Reem's come into culmination and seeing these foods, you know, particularly my mom, all of the influences of her cuisine sort of coming mm-hmm. into play, they were just so, I think, really taken aback. And I think my dad will always have a special place because he knows Reem's was born in the time that we went to that, mm-hmm. you know, at least the idea of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's funny. You ask about like Oakland, and I think what I'm doing also is pushing even the Arab community to understand what does it mean to live in different cities in the U.S. Because, so for instance, the Fruitvale, our location in Oakland, is right under the platform where Oscar Grant, which is the young Black man who was killed by the police, by the BART, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you know, like the killing of unarmed Black men has been happening for a long time in this country. And we really wanted to pay homage to that. We wanted to pay homage to the like vibrant Latinx community that lived in that Reams dwells in. And I think that was really eye-opening for my parents. They like brought me to the white suburbs because it's safe. And so mm-hmm. there's like a lot of inherent racism mm-hmm. that is, even in immigrant communities, there's a lot of anti-Blackness and there's, mm-hmm. colorism. You know, just like a fear of colorism, fear of the unknown. And there were, so I think for them to sort of understand that like all of my, you know, Reams is 90% people of color. And it's, I was very intentional about my hiring and making sure that people with the most barriers to employment get cultivated and get prioritized first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it was like such an experience for my mom to see that, like this, like young woman right out of high school, like being able to pronounce our food and like mm-hmm. say what it's about with enthusiasm. And I think that was like really heartwarming for them. It's like other people talking about our cuisine and like taking it on as their own.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah, I think that was really cool. And I think that that is one of the beauties of Reams. It's like both my locations sort of sit in these really ethnically diverse communities that have people from all walks of life. And when I imagined Reams, I actually didn't think that Arabs were going to be my first. They're not my primary target market. I wanted mm-hmm. to really bring this culture that was so beautiful to me to larger audience. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny how ingrained, you know, racism. I mean, naturally, I thought white audience because like they're the ones with all the money and not in the know. But actually, it's not just for a white audience, you know, like I think that there are a lot of similarities of Arab culture with other communities of color.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the way that we make our bread on the Saj is like how they make tortillas on the comal. Mm-hmm. And like, even I call it a tortilla sometimes. Like, that's how my mm-hmm. worker, you know, that's how like a lot of my cooks call it that. And that's cool, right?
It's like, really cool.
I think it's like what Anna was saying is like the sort of similarities of cultures and yet so different. And
yeah,
I don't know. So I think that was like a really cool thing for my parents to see.
I'm so glad.
It's like Arab culture being reflected in this like very multicultural setting.
Yeah. As much as my parents didn't understand why I was like pursuing filmmaking or art at all, when I started being very open about like, I was raised Muslim, I'm Syrian, and I incorporated that into like my work, my dad was so proud. He was just like,
yeah.
I realized how important that was to him. And I don't believe in any religion now, but I say that I'm Muslim because I really think it's a culture at this point. Like I'm very influenced by my Muslim upbringing.
Yeah.
And so to kind of make your parents understand that just because you didn't follow exactly what they wanted for you, it's still a very important thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just really, that gets me every time when I think about, I don't know, the look on my dad's face sometimes or my mom being happy. I don't know.
My dad said he's read every single thing that's been written about me. I'm like, uh-oh. But, you know, like they follow from afar and they're like smitten. Like I'm working on a cookbook and like they're all over that cookbook. And, you know, it's like you're seen and you're visible. And there's mm-hmm. just something really powerful about that. So,
yeah,
I think
This has been truly wonderful. You are wonderful and such
you
a joy to talk
to. You guys are awesome. I love
you're
talking
to you. You're very awesome. Like, I'm going to stalk your social media right after this. But tell the audience where they can find you online if you want to be found and what we can like look forward to from Reams. And if anyone's in the Oakland area, please, or Bay Area in general, you know, the BART is very good to use, but go to Reams. It's I can't wait to go for the first time to Reams.
Your Fruitvale station location, I used to hang out at that station all the time. I had a friend who lived right next to it. It was before Reams showed up there, but that was like my spot. Like I would always hang out there. I was around, I think I was probably like 21, 22, maybe 20 when I was hanging out there. But I'm sad I missed it because mm-hmm. I'd already left, you know, whatever, graduated and moved to LA by that point. Yeah. But that was my hangout spot.
Maybe a Reams in LA at some point.
I would hope so. That would be exciting.
My mom is always trying to convince me, and it's, you know, I have a 3-year-old now, so it's like very enticing.
Yeah.
Live next to family.
I mean, everyone asked me, or like a lot of people asked me, like, where's the best Syrian food? Where's the best Arabic food in LA? And I honestly,
but there's so many, right?
There's a lot of them.
So much competition.
There's a lot of them, but the best is, in my opinion, kind of is in Anaheim, and I feel like we can bring it a little bit closer. There's been an each place called Forn El Hara.
Oh, Forn El Hara. Yeah,
I love that place. Yeah. In LA, I will say Marouche in East LA is very good. But we need a Reams. I'm just saying. We need more.
We need more of it. There's never enough.
I can't think of a Palestinian place. I really can't.
That's true. You know? That's true. Yeah, we get a little flavor of everything, not just Manish. Yeah.
Yeah.
For folks who want to follow me on the interwebs, you can follow me on at Reams, Reem-Aseel. I think it's Reem. Or underscore? Sure, what is my...
I mean, if you look up her name, it will come up.
It'll pop up. Or Reams California for our whereabouts. And my website also, the Reams California, we kind of keep folks up to date there. And we are just planning for a reopening of our mission location after a very unfortunate incident with our oven exploding right before the year's end. I know. It's like if 2020 couldn't have gotten any worse.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're doing a grand opening next, or a soft opening at the end of this month. So,
oh, amazing.
Yeah, come check us out. We're doing a few fun suhoor, like Ramadan pop-ups with so stay tuned for that. My website is reem-aseel.com. I think I got all the basics.
Yeah. Just put her name into Instagram, Twitter. You'll find her. You know,
it's all.
Twitter, but I'm still figuring out how to use that thing.
It's all going to be tagged in the description below, so you can easily find it.
But yeah, this has been a joy. You're going to have to come back.
Yes.
And
talk when we
to
can,
us some
when
more.
The world goes back to a little healthier.
Oh,
maybe
Reams
we'll do
is
another
the first
pop
place
up
I'm
down
going.
There.
Yeah, no, Reams is the
or
first
I'll come
place
down
I'm
there.
Going. Oh yeah, that's true.
Another Supra Diamond.
Yes, I would love that. I missed out big time, so I really need to
that
get
was
it
such
that.
A fun event. That was so amazing.
It really was. But okay, this is Ethnically Ambiguous, Ethnically And AMB on Twitter, and Ethnically And Big on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shiro Hero on Instagram and Shiro Hero 666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hosni on Twitter.
And until next time, go to Reams if you can.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.